Hello everyone and welcome to the Christmas special of Hidden Histories. Thank you so much to all of you who subscribe to Hidden Histories. It's really not an easy thing to run a podcast, and it's the lovely messages and feedback and support that I've had from all of you that keep it going. So I've been incredibly busy the last 6 months producing a series for BBC4 on the execution of Charles I. It comes out tonight at 9 p.m, so go forth and watch it. There's a lot of hard work that has gone into the production, and I was fortunate enough to work with some of the best people in telly, so it would mean a lot to me if all of you watched that. 2020 is looking very exciting for Hidden Histories. Lots more great guests lined up and possibly a new collaboration, which will be revealed in the new year. Now, as Christmas specials go, I'm pretty pleased with this one, for he is a very special, very lovely and very talented guest. The international man of history, the broadcaster, podcaster, producer, writer and historian, Dan Snow, MBE. Now, Dan is very modest in his involvement with this podcast because it was actually on the back of his wonderful History Hit network that Hidden Histories spread its fledgling wings and over the last 9 months has subsequently grown. So thank you, Dan, for your support. Now, Dan has a career that we all envy. And as a self-proclaimed generalist, he is really one of the few historians who has a general understanding of history, from the 5th century BC to the Cold War, rather than a specialism which is usually born from academic study. However, Dan has proven that his input as a generalist is hugely important, inspiring old and young globally to take an interest in the study of the past. He talks about his career, the remarkable experience he's had, and what you can do to start broadcasting and blogging about history just as he does. Please rate and subscribe. And above all, enjoy this Christmas special and all of you have a wonderful Christmas. Dan Snow, welcome to Hidden Histories.
Thank you very much, Helen. What a treat to be on.
Well, I think, the Hidden Histories wouldn't actually exist if it wasn't for you. It was the history hit that started it in the first place.
It came out of that stable. Well, you know, we might have had a very small hand in it, but it's all because of your passion and expertise and enthusiasm that it's all happening. So well done you.
Thank you. But we're going to talk about general history and your career as a general historian. A general something. But you presented your first programme, 18 years ago, after a cursory Wikipedia search?
That might be true. It might be 18. Yeah, I think, 17, 18 years ago. That's true. So, yeah, I've had a very odd life and I really don't know how to define it. But I did undergraduate history degree and I was all ready and excited about the next stage, and I was going to do postgraduate study probably around the 18th century. Or rather the very early 9th century, so Napoleonic Wars period. And then I was rowing in the Oxford and Cambridge boat race, and somebody at the BBC saw that and suggested a programme. Because I was talking about history, that they have to, as you'll know from watching the Oxford Cambridge boat race, it's a very boring event, so they have to fill it up with videos of students sort of going to the library and doing whatever. And I went on a kind of weird little tour around Oxford with the camera crew and talked about some of the buildings and some of the history. And someone at the BBC in the development department saw that as just a programme, and then that programme, the idea got twisted and moved around, and eventually they stuck me together with my dad, who was a journalist, and we made a programme together. And one thing led to another. So really it was a kind of, obviously just a blinding stroke of luck, an extraordinary, huge privilege. And here I am. And I've sort of, and I've just been doing, I've tried, I've done a few books and podcasts and TV shows and various things ever since.
I was going to say, it's just gone from step by step, hasn't it? You've got your own history channel, your own history podcast, and now you've also got an MBE. It's been a big year.
Yeah, I guess I was just about young enough to be a sort of digital native. And I guess I walked into an industry that was just in the last few years of what a previous incarnation, which had been, BBC Two was one of only five channels that most people had. And yet I was kind of on the internet and I was watching videos and things online. And I was aware that this was all about to suddenly change. So right from the beginning, I was quite keen to do history and take history onto these new platforms and see what the history could offer. And I was really excited because it was very clear to me when I made a program about the Battle of Hastings that the last place you wanted to watch a program about the Battle of Hastings was in your lounge watching the telly. You wanted to watch that when you were out and about on the battlefield or, you know, looking at the landscape. So the idea that you could have portable video sounds so old-fashioned already talking about this, but that just seemed to me really, really obvious. And I've just spent the last decades now, goodness me, I've spent that trying to work out how you can pay for that and how you can make that and how you can get that as high quality and so that people can watch history wherever they are. Of course, if they're on the Battle of Hastings, that helps, but they can be in any field or any house around the world.
I think you've always been pretty forward-thinking with that sort of thing. I mean, you were I think you probably pioneered the history podcast. I mean, you had the sort of catch-up BBC ones like In Our Time, but you really carried it forward and you had the guests. You really made... Do you think the History Hits brand started out of that podcast?
Well, for years, I was trying to work out ways. I think lots of independent scholars I meet and authors and historians who don't have academic tenure, they're all trying to work out a way of supporting themselves doing it. And people do tours and they do advice, the consultancy with museums, heritage sector. They do, you know, speeches, they write books, of course, and do television and consulting work and all sorts of stuff, right? And I was in the same boat. I was just thinking, this is really very exciting to be working at the BBC, but it's clearly really insubstantial and transitory because if someone comes in who quite rightly just goes, who's this Dan Snow guy? I've got no interest in having him on the channel. Then I'm doomed. My career is in like a very small number of hands. A very small number of people kind of control my career. And as you get older, that's, my goodness, that's like your mortgage and your kids' futures and everything. Yeah. So it's quite scary.
That's the thing about telly. You never know until you know.
No, you never know.
You know what I mean? You never know if it's going to happen until it's fully like signed off. It's definitely happening. And that can be days before something even gets going. So you're right. You do need to carve something out that is yours.
Totally. And I also was really aware that because in a way the danger was I was building my house on sand because I wasn't becoming an area expert. I wasn't becoming, you know, the greatest, you know, world's greatest expert on the Carthaginians, which meant that whenever there was a TV program about the Carthaginians, you kind of had to be consulted, although that's sadly not true. So I was kind of aware that I was in danger of spreading myself really thinly, and I was very vulnerable to a change of fashion, change of the wind. And so I tried making apps for iPads, and back in the day, I don't know if you remember, there were those sort of pyramid
tables. I remember
table
you doing
and,
that, yeah.
And they were beautiful apps. So I started this thing called sort of History Hit and tried to, I mean, I belatedly tried to start something on YouTube. We made some apps for quite beautiful apps, actually, a timeline of World War II, which is still one of the, I'm really proud of that. But, you know, again, it's hard to get people to buy them, basically. And then a wonderful friend and colleague called Dan Morrell said, what about a podcast? And I said, yeah, that sounds cool. But, you know, I thought that podcasts were really like old fashioned. I remember listening to like Ricky Gervais podcast in like 2000. And so in 2015, it felt like it was past the time, but it turns out that was actually the beginning of the beginning of a sort of second great huge bubble. Now everyone's got a podcast. I mean,
it's huge.
It's nuts. And so I was just, again, very lucky to get in there and a little bit early. But no, I think, you know, History Magazine's got wonderful podcasts. They were going for years before me. So I can't claim to be an innovator there. I came in late, but I came in hard.
Well, I listened to all of them, and I think yours was. I think I enjoyed yours the most, and I, you know, I probably shouldn't say that, but but I mean, so you write books, you make TV, you appear in front of the camera, so you're a big part of behind the camera as well, especially with History Hit. What do you think your favourite part of the job is now?
Definitely, when I was young, it was so, you know, narcissistic and enjoyable to prance around on camera and have people think that was quite cool. But now, as you get older, and the real satisfaction comes from definitely doing a bit of work behind the camera. Like, I love scripting and deciding what films we're going to make on History Hits, and you know, cutting and using these wonderful experts or eyewitness veterans or whatever it might be for a Second World War film, and using their voices in the right place and trying to kind of craft something. So that's really exciting. But it's still nice to be responsible for telling the story. It's still nice to have the words coming out of your mouth, because then you've got kind of oversight of the process from end to end, and that's lovely. And I guess the funnest bit is still going somewhere where it is where you're really responding to the environment you're in. Either there's an archaeological dig which is unfolding in front of your eyes, or you're, you know, there's the result of the DNA analysis is you're being told it and you respond to it, or you just go somewhere completely amazing. Like recently, I went to Timbuktu with the Red Cross, and you are able to then, you're able to tell that story, but as you're experiencing it yourself, and that is such an exciting and wonderful thing to do. So that's still, I'm so lucky. The day I landed my first ever TV show, Battle of Alamein, and I landed in Egypt, and we drove out and across the desert in a Jeep, and I thought, this is heaven. I can't believe my luck. I'm telling the story of this great campaign that I've heard about ever since I was a kid. I remember thinking, I can't believe I'm gonna say the words like Africa Corps and Rommel and bombardment, these kind of words that you've only read about or you've heard people on telly or lecturers say, and I can't believe I'm going to form those words and put them into sentences and try and explain them to people. It just felt like it just felt like something I never thought I'd be doing. And then to do it in Egypt, to do it, having the adventure and the car would get stuck in the sand and we'd have to dig it out and tow out the other vehicle. And it just felt like I was living a life less ordinary, and I couldn't believe my luck. And I still can't believe my luck. So it's that basic excitement of going to the places and telling the story that I still feel almost two decades later. And really, well, I mean, it's lucky.
But it is exciting as well, because often what people don't know is when you work in telly, you actually get to touch artifacts or go to places, be allowed into locations that you wouldn't get to do if you were doing any other type of research, because there are so many different doors open to you when you're doing TV or you're doing something for media purposes. You do get to experience some quite unique and amazing things, don't you?
Yeah, I mean, you're absolutely right, because of the tyranny of TV. I mean, I do wonder if as TV dwindles in terms of its audiences and its reach, maybe the next generation, maybe all these millennials who are like the new curators and the new archivists will be like, who do you think you are, man? It's not, I think, like, get your hands off that document. But certainly, yeah, I benefited from being at the tail end of a world in which to be on TV was everything, to be for a charity, for a museum, for an organization, for a political party, for a business, to get on the telly, especially the BBC, was like, oh my goodness, this is a guaranteed audience of millions and millions of people. So yeah, we arrive. I've handled the French constitution of the early 1790s, where they tried to, where they tried this sort of balanced constitution with, so the king was still in it. It was before King Louis had been tried and executed, and they'd gone for a more radical republican option. And I remember handling that in the archives in Paris, just thinking, this is just an unimaginable experience. And the same is true of as you know, documents, letters, sources, manuscripts, whether it's the manuscripts that were smuggled out of Timbuktu that I've recently been lucky enough to see in Mali as they're undergoing restoration, or like Captain Bligh, the tiny little artifacts in the National Maritime Museum with which he sustained himself and his crew in the open boat after they were kicked off the Bounty, whether it's what he used to navigate or what he used to measure out the rations or the fresh water ration. So yeah, I've handled extraordinary things from different periods, right across history and right across the world.
And with that, we've talked about this before, the value of general history, and there is so much within history that's put on expertise. And obviously there is so much to say about expertise, and it's so important. I mean, you wouldn't do your job if there wasn't people who were experts. But I think there is a value in being a general historian as well. Why do you think that's so important, particularly today?
Well, I think, my job description is something that causes a huge amount of upset with people. And I guess I've always just looked for a way to describe it. So what I do is every day I talk about history, think about history, write about history, and broadcast history. But if sometimes it's easy to call yourself a history broadcaster, Greg Jenner, wonderful, he calls himself a public historian. Mm. You can call yourself. I'm actually very relaxed about people, and some people just go, like, the guy's a journalist, and again, that's kind of fine. I don't really mind. It just strikes me that given all the only area in which I work is history, therefore, I kind of I try not to call myself anything really, because it just is drives people totally understandably crazy sometimes.
Had the same thing. It's really different. Sometimes people say, "What do you do?" I'm like, "Well, a producer, public historian, historian, medievalist." I don't know.
History writer. I'm someone who writes history books, And again, I'm the one who's been very privileged to do this. And if people, especially in the academy, think, well, you don't get to call yourself a historian, then that's fine. I mean, I'm very, very relaxed about that. So, but in terms of what the job that I do, which is to kind of a very shallow but quite wide, like discussion of history, sharing of stories, sharing of other people's expertise, amplifying historians' work, which I hope I do on the podcast and through other ways. Yeah, I think, of course, there's a role for that. And I quite like...
And I
quite like being a generalist, quite like being a, you know, whatever even the word is. And that is... It's such a treat to go and meet with wonderful historians on a day-by-day basis and talk to them about their work. And then you're always the stupidest guy in the room. It's lovely because you're always the guy who goes, I kind of know a little bit about Portuguese intrusion into the Indian Ocean in the 15th and 16th centuries. And you're like trying to keep up, but you can't really, but you're enough to vaguely keep the conversation going. And then you stagger out of that and you're then talking about the Eastern Front in the Second World War. And you stagger out of that and you're talking about domestication of crops at the very dawn of history. And it's great. And that's exciting, and I hope I've been able to be someone that can help to sit between the academy, the experts, the real historians, whatever, and the public, and I that's where I feel that I am, that's really all I've ever wanted to do. I mean, I've probably written one proper history book really in my 20s when I was desperate to prove myself, and I wrote a book about the Seven Years' War. And I got sort of, I went, you know, you go mad. You just become an expert in the North American theatre of the French Indian or Seven Years' War, however you wish to name it. And I just kind of went a bit bananas. And I ended up worrying far more about my endnotes than I was worrying about the narrative, because I wanted to impress the kind of four people in the world that knew more about the 1759 campaign that culminated with the capture of Quebec in Canada. And I thought, actually, I don't think... There's so many people that are doing this better than me. There's so many wonderful people that are steeped in the sources and have become area experts. But what I think I can do is kind of play a role where actually, yeah, I'm just hopping from period to period and trying to amplify it and trying to engage and try and enthuse about it. And I don't think, you know, I people often say mean things to me, but I don't think that I'm in any way distracting attention away from... I'm not convincing people that would otherwise have read an in-depth history of Chinese naval exploration in the Indian Ocean. I don't think I'm saying, don't read that, come and listen to my podcast. Like, I think actually anyone who listens to podcasts or engages or watches those TV shows is probably more likely to read the specialist literature. A historian once very kindly said to me when I was having a kind of crisis of confidence when I was in my late 20s, he goes, "No, you know, rising tide floats all boats. They watch your shows and they buy my books. I'm thrilled."
Yeah, absolutely. And you know, you said, the stupidest person in the room. I don't agree with that at all. I think it takes a lot of skill to be able to navigate that, as you say, that very shallow water between the academy and the general public. It's not easy to be able to gear an interview in the correct way, especially with somebody who has so much knowledge, detailed knowledge on something so vast or so intricate. That is a skill in itself and actually is quite hard work. And it's something that, you know, I've sort of looked to you to learn from how to do myself. And it can be really tough.
Well, it's tough. It gets easier as you get older and a bit more confident. You stop worrying about people thinking you're stupid. Like, that's the nice thing. So the nice thing about my situation now is I love asking stupid questions. Like, I love just going, hold on. I've completely forgotten who Henry IV was. Like, and so please remind me, because I've got no idea. And that's really nice. Like, so that's great that, if you know, I don't. If people are listening, if I've dragged people this far and they still think I'm an idiot, then they're right. I'm probably an idiot, and I'm not going to change that. I'm not going to change their
but
opinion.
But isn't that really nice that the general public have somebody like you who's able to ask those questions?
Well, that's a very nice question of you to ask. I guess so. Yeah, I mean, I think so. I mean, I hope. You know, there are times when I get things wrong and people correct me on my Twitter feed when I'm putting out. And I get hugely embarrassed, I get mortified, you know, and I think, oh God, am I part of the problem? Am I one of these new like fake news phenomena that's just pumping out and just actually worsening people's historical understanding? And you know, of course, on your bad days, that's the terror. All I can say is you just strive to be better than that. You strive to be good. You strive to improve and make sure that you're not being that guy.
But we're also getting history wrong all the time. I mean, it's, you know, that's a whole other subject. Who owns history, whatever, that's a whole other thing. But you know, we're always getting everyone gets things wrong. I mean, it's such a vast subject, isn't it? It's like, I bet you're the most amazing person to have on a pub quiz though.
Well, I'm actually rubbish at pub quiz because unfortunately I'm all right at the history round, but I'm terrible at everything else. I'm, like the 1980s sport is just really hard. But also the trouble with history is a lot of it, Helen Carr, and everyone at the history round, everyone kind of just throws their pencils down the desk and at the table and just goes, right, well, I'll go and have a pint. And then you're expecting anything you get wrong, it's like mortified. So
I know,
actually,
I sort of slightly dread pub quizzes
because they go, oh, now the next question is, you know, about French politics in the 1970s. And you just go, oh God.
Yeah.
It is.
You know, well, like ancient Athens, and you're just like,
Athens, yeah. Well, I quite like the old 5th century BC. I'm all right at that because I, you know, that's one of the things. It is odd when you make programs for TV, you end up absorbing what everyone else thinks is history. So you end up, like in my kind of personal interest is very much 18th century and then other bits dotted around. And then for the podcast, I go all over history. But what's with TV, it's going to be like ancient Greece and Rome, a bit of high medieval, so a bit of kind of castle-y, you know, ye olde.
And then often
with a little visit to 1066. And then a lot of First and Second World War. And I've ended up, to be honest, my dark secret is that I was never that bothered about the First and Second World War at university.
Which is so funny because I feel like you're really the BBC's pin-up for that.
I mean,
now.
I just bought, but no, but they, you know, but there's a huge public appetite for it. And so I've ended up, and of course, actually, I love it now because it is totally extraordinary. I can totally see why people lose themselves and why there's a certain type of strange middle-aged history fan that just like disappears into the toilet to read 3 hours about the Third Reich. Because it is this kind of utterly monstrous example from incredibly recent history.
Yeah, yeah. It's baffling, actually. When you really think about it, it's baffling.
Yeah, and it's a society so like ours that dissolves into genocide and extremism on a kind of on an epic scale. And it is also the largest and most destructive war, the Second World War, and if you like, together, the First and Second World, the great crisis of the 20th century, is the largest, most destructive event in human history, like a military event. Tens of millions of people killed, wounded, displaced, entire societies reshaped, empires. Like, it's not wholly surprising. And loads of our granddads fought in it, and our grandmas.
It's not hugely
surprising that everyone's kind of into it. Like, it's not, I don't sit there going, you can still ask
people questions about it. Who were there? Yeah. And that's amazing.
And I live in Southampton, and the entire city was reshaped by it. Literally, the architecture of this city, the character of the city. So it's not, again, I don't think that people are weird. I mean, if everyone was just sitting around totally obsessing about the Crimean War all the time, that would be a bit like, that would be kind of a bit niche. I'd be like, why is everyone into it? I mean, it's interesting, but, and so therefore I kind of think people should be forgiven for finding that utterly, utterly fascinating. And the stories that can, and of course there's lots of archive, you know, we know lots about it. So you're able to understand it in a richness. I mean, every time a new Holocaust history comes out, I read it. And we just had one on the podcast. They just another family, another survival story, another story about Auschwitz. And it's just totally amazing. It's like the most amazing story you're ever going to hear. And it's just one of a million books that will be written about the Holocaust.
Yeah. We were talking about World War II and the 20th century, but you have said that your passions lie in the 18th century. Is there anything in particular, is there anything quite specific about that? So if you were going to go and write another book as a complete passion project on the 18th century, what would you write on?
I love maritime history, and I'm obsessed with like maritime technology and how, I think when I was growing up, there was a bit too much great man history, and there was a bit too much Whiggish history about Britain's ascent to sort of global hegemony. And I think I'm kind of increasingly fascinated by like why these random Western European nations managed to sort of conquer to a large extent the rest of the world with, you know, astonishing impacts for both those societies and the ones that, found themselves bearing the brunt of that advance. And I'm very interested by, you know, the technology. Like, is it just cannon and heavier built Carvel ships and rigging and navigation? Like, that's so... And then when you're living through an era where technology is proving so decisive, again, in the 80s and 90s, maybe, obviously it was a time of rapid technological change, but it wasn't being rammed down our throats. Like, you know, the Russians just hacked the US election by using Facebook, you know. Like, we're very attuned these days to the idea that an actually seemingly quite a small tweak to technology, so someone releasing a kind of a new social media platform, can actually have kind of geostrategic effect. And so I do wonder increasingly, like, you know, when I was growing up, it was all British. We thought it was all about kind of Protestantism and the rule of law and venture capital and patent law and innovation. It was all these kind of things in a kind of virtuous circle. But I increasingly wonder whether we're just overlooking some of the more prosaic reasons for that kind of explosion of Western European hard power and trading might and industrial might, stuff like that. So, but if I had to write a book about the 18th century, I'd probably stick with the Seven Years' War because I've already got a bit of a head start. And I'd write probably a global history of the Seven Years' War, which would be is really fascinating to me. But yeah, but that's a big mission, and writing a book is you know so well, you know I'm a dad, and I'm quite hands on, and I think to turn your house into your place of work, like to when you're writing a book, it's in your own house, and that is I think to a certain extent you bring down a curtain, but between you and those around you, and I'm kind of unwilling to do that just at the moment. My kids quite like me, to be honest. They haven't quite reached the age where they realise what a loser I am. So I'm just sort of keen to max that out. And so at the moment, my career is short, sharp bursts of broadcasting. And that suits me a little bit better, I think.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
So what do you think our kids we'll be looking at in the future when it comes to history? I mean, there's some great things like Horrible Histories, which I love. But, you know, talking about apps and podcasts and various tech trends going forward, I think you're really good, actually, at seeing what sort of things are coming up with that. How do you see the learning and the portrayal of history coming?
Well, I just think VR's going to explode. I mean, surely. I just can't. Yeah. I just think... The you know, you will be going into Tutankhamun's tomb. You will be seeing what, you know, Renaissance Florence looked like. You will be watching the great fleet of early 15th century China depart and return from its voyages. I just think that is. Obviously, you know, the gaming community are way ahead of us at the moment. And I've done a little bit of work recently with some of the gamers who draw their inspiration from historical stories. And it's just, I mean, that's just the future. It's just,
yeah, of course, like the Assassin's Creed type. I mean, that was yeah. Into a movie, wasn't it? Yeah, that sort of.
Yeah, thing. And that's right. So I guess it would get cheaper to produce. But I mean, at the moment, it's still a huge barrier to entry. So, like, I would love to create a VR experience where you go and look at what, you know, that I don't know, the Boston Tea Party, right? But actually, that is still, it's still quite unachievable. Whereas making video of me poncing about or you and I recording this podcast, that's become very much more realizable on a small budget. So that I think will have a massive impact, and taking people to places without them having to go there will be huge. And an experience I've had with my kids, when I go to, I was in the Dutch Maritime Museum the other day with my kids in Amsterdam, the Rijksmuseum, and they got a VR experience there that is absolutely astonishing. And my kids just could not believe their eyes. You know, they just loved it. And in, as a way of transmitting historical information and art and other things to kids, it's just
it's really powerful. So it's really powerful. Really powerful stuff. Yeah,
so that would be that's my guess. Will audio survive? I don't know, these podcasts. You know, my guess is that audios might struggle to survive self-driving cars, because once people can sit in the back and just chill, will they listen to as much audio? I don't know. People, the audio revolution is kind of interesting at the moment, so that might sustain.
Yeah, that's interesting.
But yeah, so that's what they were. And also, great lesson from history is that there is almost no point predicting, because there'll be something that we haven't worked out yet.
True.
If the last 30 years are anything to go by.
Absolutely. And you must get people going, how do I get to do what you do all the time? Like whenever you go to schools or unis, or you probably just get loads of emails and tweets. What advice, because I know that that's the sort of thing that people who are listening to this will want to know. What sort of advice do you have for people who would like to do that?
Well, in the old days, that was hard, actually, because it was just the ridiculously random and deeply unfair choice, you know, a capricious nature of television, that just somehow you'd bump into someone on a tube, or, you know, I remember, you know, Joe Frost was super nanny, and it's because she was a nanny to a TV exec's kids, and he just thought, let's make a program with you, you know, like it was that capricious. And my career is absolutely, I owe everything to that complete, you know, swing fate, basically. However, I think today is a bit easier, because today we can at least broadcast. We can at least, and you know, it's amazing how many people say to me, I really want to do what you do. And I say, the first thing I say, well, oh God, send me some videos that you've done. And 99% of them haven't done videos. And I'm like, oh, okay. Well, now that you've got a supercomputer in your pocket with an editing function on it and ability to shoot 4K, I mean, nearly everyone's got that. Well, then do something. Like go and film yourself somewhere enthusing about it and being interested in it and chop it together. And in a way, that has been a revolution. In the old days, you had to like pay someone a huge amount of money to make a showreel, which was a gigantically kind of narcissistic thing to do. Now just go and do it. When next time you're out visiting HMS Victory or you're out looking at something, go and just get a mate, turn a camera on you and see if you like it and see if you're any good at it. And then Dropbox it to a few people and get some ideas, get some feedback.
Yeah, I remember doing that for History Hit. And initially I felt so embarrassed.
I know, it was definitely
but
embarrassing.
Actually, after a while, it gets fun. And it's like, you do get kind of used to it. And God, I remember doing it when my daughter was strapped to me. She was practically newborn. And I went and did this little sort of 5-10 minute thing at some Viking festival or something, and it was really fun. So I think that's really good. I think that's really good advice, actually, to just go for it. And if it's something that you're passionate about and you really want to do, then you can just do it. You don't need to wait for somebody else to give you the go ahead.
I'm following several people on Instagram at the moment who are just private citizens, but they are incredibly engaging, and Instagram, every new update makes it more. So, like, I mean, people need to realize there is more usability on Instagram now, today, than I was able to access at the start of my television career with all the backing at the BBC. You know, you can animate Instagram, you can live stream, you can broadcast around the world live, you can patch people into that broadcast, you know, from with your phone. Like, that is. You have the resources at your fingertips that we could only dream about at the BBC at the start of my career. So really, I think if people do want to do that and pursue history in that kind of way, I think just start trying and messing about with, whether it's live streaming or whether it's, and you know, wonderful, you know, posts that have and elements of text, elements of audio, elements of video, elements of animation, none of the above. You know, try stuff, and then share it.
Start a podcast.
Start a
podcast. Everyone's got one these days. Anyway, so Hidden Histories. We have to talk about something hidden. that you know about? I bet you know so many hidden histories. Where can you give me a few amazing locations that you've been to that you think that a little bit off the beaten track? Because you've filmed in some of the most incredible places.
Right. We're talking the UK.
Yeah, let's do a couple of weeks. It'd be nice for people to be able to go to them, but we can talk about some other
Okay, well, I mean, you know, there are so many. I mean, it's bewildering. But I think I just think the ones that I went to the other day, I mean, I think Chatham, the dockyards at Chatham are kind of undervalued, a totally remarkable place to learn about our maritime history, not as now famous as your sort of big historic ships in Bristol and Portsmouth and London, but Chatham has got an amazing the rope walk at Chatham is simply one of the great national treasures of this country. This giant factory setting to knit ropes together for the ships of the Royal Navy, and they use bicycles to get from one end to the other. It's completely extraordinary. So that's worth seeing. I've just come back from the Channel Islands, which have got, you know, the fact that they're the only part, they're only sort of British territory in the Second World War, they're actually occupied by the Germans. And the stories there, people were sent off to prison and death camps on the continent. The landscape was upended by the Germans. It was fortified, straddled in concrete and iron. And there, it's the only place I've ever been there where you get Henry VIII fortification is next to Hitler. Hitler and Henry. So everyone used to tease about the GCSE syllabus and talk about it's just Hitler and the Henrys. Well, I've never been anywhere where you get clearer sense of the Hitler and the Henrys than, say the fort at the castle at Guernsey, which is extraordinary. One of the last places, and also one of the last places in Britain and its islands, broadly defined, which held out for King Charles during the Civil War as well. Okay, so what else? Hidden histories. I mean, I think Britain's industrial history actually is hidden, and especially to Southerners and to lots of probably sort of university trained historians, we don't pay enough attention to the kind of slew of extraordinary industrial museums and heritage sites particularly across the north of England and up into the central belt of Scotland. You know, Ironbridge is simply the best.
Yeah, the architecture speaks volumes.
Incredible. And, you know, what happened in Ironbridge and what happened in the West Midlands and elsewhere, you know, the fact that the first intercity railway, you know, Manchester, the fact that the rocket is still in Manchester. The fact that that stretch of railway line is still in use. The fact that that was the first in-city railway between Liverpool and Manchester in 1830. Those are crucibles of the modern world. You know, the economic, the sort of industrial advances here, with profound consequences, obviously for every aspect of the world, but increasingly we're now obviously really in climate as well. But so I think, you know, whether it's Quarry Bank Mill outside Manchester, whether it is in the West Midlands, Ironbridge, there are just glorious places to kind of see that to a certain extent lost history, but and a history that matters to everyone living on the planet today. So there's some other ones I'd say.
Thanks, Dan. And what are you up to at the moment? Was there anything?
What I'm up to at the moment?
What are you up to now?
Trying to keep the podcast ticking along, trying to get the TV channel up and running. It's quite exciting. We're doing all right on the old TV channel. So yeah, it's good. No, things are going well, and just really keen, basically, to try and do everything. I've gone to quite a lot of effort with the TV channel and podcast, but all I've ever wanted to do is a way to support me and a team and people like you and other presenters, of course, and historians, just to keep putting great history content out there. And whether it was going to be via YouTube or via apps on iPads or podcasts or video on demand channels with subscription, I'm not that fussed. I just wanted to get it done. So at the moment we're realizing that goal, and it's amazing. You know, it used to be even just 2 years ago for we got the anniversary of the liberation of Belsen coming up. And it used to be that I would wait to be sent there by the BBC, but now, you know, the organisers have asked me to go on just as me, as History Hit, as this new kind of broadcaster, and that is the best, because then there's no one telling you what you can't do and really can do and edit you absolutely. And all that kind of thing. So it's great.
Oh, that's wonderful. And for anybody, because this is the Christmas special, anybody who's looking to buy a history related Christmas gift.
Well, thank you. Yeah, go to shop. www.historyhit.com. There are some calendars on there, which I've got to say we're now into double figures selling calendars for next year.
Are they
year.
All of you? Are they is
no,
every
they're not all of
image?
Me. One is of me, the one is not of me.
Right, okay.
You can choose and you can decide which one to buy. So we've got to get the calendar. No, anyway, so yeah, you've got lots of weird historical stuff on there for Christmas. So if you're in this, if you listen to this in the run up to Christmas, you've got a desperate last minute gift you need to buy, go up there. You're going to sort all, it sorts you out. So thank you very much. And then obviously I'll be looking forward to reading your new book in the new year, Helen.
Yes, on that note, I think it's time to say goodbye.
Okay.
No, writing. No. My new book, absolutely. That's exactly what I'm about to go and do. I'm going to go and do some writing. Great. Thank you so much, Dan. You've been amazing. And, you know, you've been a massive help to me in forging my career. And I think you will be an inspiration to many other young people, many other young historians. Thank you so much. And I'll have you on the podcast again soon to talk about all of your new projects and see how History Hit has developed, maybe in a few months or a year or so.
Thank you.
Thanks, Dan.